Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland podcast, episode 49, The Nobles of William I. I'm your host Fraser, and today we delve deeper into the intricate web of noble families during the reign of William I, their allegiances, conflicts, and contributions to the Scottish kingdom as it stood at the threshold of the 12th century. Before we embark on this journey, I'd like to take a moment to express my heartfelt thanks for all the kind comments left on Spotify and our Facebook page. Your feedback is a beacon that guides this show. I also acknowledge my ongoing battle with pronunciations, a challenge I face head on, with your guidance turning my missteps into stepping stones towards improvement. I appreciate everyone's patience and instructional comments. They have been invaluable, and for that I'm really grateful. As I said, I'm not really a true historian, I'm a self-taught one, and that comes to podcasting as well. Very self-taught, learning pronunciations as I go, learning to better the episode and podcast as we continue through Scottish history, so that way the information I'm telling is always correct and sounds right in your ears. Anyway, in our last episode, we continued exploring the reign of William, focusing on his marriage to Ermengarde de Beaumont, a direct descendant of King Henry I of England. This union was not just a matrimonial alliance, but a strategic move that positioned Scotland on a path diverging from English influence, aiming for a resurgence of independence. We uncovered the layers of William's successful suppression of the last rebellions, setting a firm foundation for his rule and aspirations for Scotland's autonomy from the looming figure of King Richard the Lionheart. Additionally, we delved into William's confrontation with Pope Alexander III over the contentious selection for the bishopric of St Andrews, a dispute emblematic of the era's intricate interplay between religious and royal powers. This episode shifts the focus to the Scottish nobility under William's reign, the intricate dynamics within his council of nobles, his closest allies, and even his adversaries. They all paint a vivid picture of Scotland during this transformative period. The Gaelic nobles, with their distinct perspectives and interests, played a crucial role in the fabric of Scottish nobility, influencing the kingdom's direction alongside their Norman counterparts. Their relationships and power structures offer a fascinating glimpse into the political landscape of Scotland's past. We'll also revisit some of the noble families discussed in episodes dedicated to Malcolm IV and David I. Their continuity is crucial to the story, as their legacy and influence of these nobles weave through the narrative of Scottish history, each generation shaping the kingdom in its own right. Understanding their evolution and impact during William's reign offers a valuable insight into Scotland's broader historical context. Looking ahead, our next episode will explore William's endeavours to fortify Scotland's independence from England, a pivotal chapter in the nation's story. But today, let's turn our attention to the nobility that stood by William's side, opposed him, and shaped the Scotland of their time. So, as always, grab a hot drink, settle in with your radio headphones, and join me as we journey back to the reign of William I, exploring the lives, loyalties, and legacies of the nobles who played the pivotal roles in the tapestry of Scottish history. During William I's reign, the Norman influence on Scotland was profound, with several Norman families playing pivotal roles in the governance, military, and cultural shaping of the kingdom. These nobles, granted lands and titles for their service from David I, became integral to the feudal system. William sought to strengthen this across Scotland. Here we'll identify some key Norman noble families, their members during William's reign, and the roles they played within the kingdom. So the first one, and probably the most famous one, which we've mentioned numerous times now, is obviously the de Brus family, or the Bruce family. Robert de Brus II, a lord with significant holdings, Robert de Brus was a prominent figure serving as a military leader and judicial figure in the Scottish kingdom. His family's lands were primarily in Arndale, establishing the Bruce family as one of the major power bases in southern Scotland. We had the de Baliol family. Hugh de Baliol served as a landholder and noble. Hugh played a significant role in the kingdom's politics. The de Baliol family's influence extended through their extensive estates in the Borders region. And don't worry, we will be doing a special Borders episode between Scotland and England and explaining the conflicts that happened down south. We had the Comyn family. Richard Comyn was the Justiciar of Scotland. Richard Comyn's role was crucial in the administration of the kingdom. The Comyn family's power was widespread, with lands in the north and the east, making one of them the most influential Norman families in Scotland. We had the St. Clair family, or they would be soon to known as Sinclair. William St. Clair held lands in Midlothian. The St. Clair family was involved in the military and court life of Scotland. Their strategic marriages further solidified their standing within the noble hierarchy. We obviously had the famous FitzAlan family. Walter FitzAlan, as a High Steward of Scotland, Walter FitzAlan was instrumental in the administration and governance of the kingdom. We've already heard him in the past few episodes, helping run the place whilst William I was, well, locked up. But yeah, his family originated from Brittany, as we know, and they held extensive lands in the west of Scotland. And then we had the de Morville family. Hugh de Morville held a position of Lord High Constable of Scotland. Hugh was a key figure in the military organisation and justice system of Scotland. His land in Ayrshire and the borders contributed to his family's prominence. These Norman nobles and their families played diverse roles in William's Scotland, from the governance and military leadership to the judicial and administrative functions. Their influence was felt across the kingdom, shaping the political and social landscape of Scotland during this period. Of the Norman nobility that defined William's Scotland, the distribution of power was not uniform, with certain families emerging as politically influential due to their expansive landholdings, strategic marriages, and pivotal roles in the governance and military framework of the kingdom. Among these were the de Bruce family and the Comyn family. They stood out as the most formidable, each wielding considerable influence from their respective power bases across the Scottish realm. The Bruce's family prominence can be attributed to their extensive estates in Arndale, a region that not only afforded them significant wealth but also a strategic position near the English-Scottish border. This geographical advantage was crucial for military mobilisation and exerting influence over trade routes that were vital for economic prosperity of the kingdom. Their power was further solidified through their active participation in the royal court and military campaigns, positioning them as indispensable allies to King William. The Bruce's family dominance in the southern Scotland areas made Arndale a key power base from which they could project their influence both within Scotland and in diplomatic engagements with England. Equally powerful, though, in a different region of Scotland were the Comyns. Their vast territories in the north and northeast, particularly in Badenoch and Buchan, positioned the Comyn family as central figures in the governance and defence of these areas. Richard Comyn served as the Justiciar of Scotland, and this exemplified the family's integration into the highest levels of Scottish governance. Their control over northern territories was not just a matter of landholding, but also a strategic advantage, enabling them to influence trade with military routes that connected Scotland with the Norse and Anglo-Norman worlds. The Comyns' ability to administer and defend these regions underscored their crucial role in the kingdom's stability and prosperity. While other noble families like the Balliols and the FitzAlans also held significant power and influence, their reach and impact were somewhat overshadowed by the extensive networks of allegiance, land, and political authority held by the Bruces and Comyns. The de Bruce family, with their estates in the borders, and the FitzAlans as stewards of Scotland and holders of the lands in the west, certainly played critical roles within the kingdom's nobility. However, the sheer scale of territorial control and political integration seen with the Bruces and Comyns marked these families as the most powerful among their peers during the reign of William. But you're probably asking yourself, and I know we've touched on it a little bit, but I do want to go back to it. What happened to the Bruce family? Well, we know the Bruce family navigated a tumultuous path through Scottish history. The Bruce's family initial fall from grace can be traced back to, again, the Battle of Standard in 1138, a significant conflict as we know. The Bruces, possessing lands on both sides of the English-Scottish border, found themselves in a precarious position. Their support, perceived or real, of the English cause in the battle led to a temporary estrangement from the Scottish crown, which was done by Bruce the Elder. Regaining their standing in the eyes of the Scottish monarchy was no small feat, and required both strategic marriages and unwavering loyalty to subsequent Scottish kings. This was done by de Bruce Younger, the son of the Bruce that let down our King David in the Battle of Standard. By the time of William I, the Bruce family held substantial lands as we know in Arndale. This region became their principal power base, from which they could exert influence and control over the southwestern parts of Scotland. The strategic importance of Arndale we've already mentioned, but it cannot be understated. Their standing with William was significantly bolstered by a strategic marriage that intertwined the Bruce family directly with the royal bloodline. Marrying into the royal family was not only cementing their position within the Scottish nobility, but it also provided them with a direct link to the monarchy, thereby enhancing their prestige and influence at court. This marriage symbolised the culmination of the Bruce's efforts to restore their standing, or more, the younger Bruce's efforts to restore their standing. It represented a mutual recognition of loyalty and service, with the Bruces pledging their support to the crown and in return receiving a place of honour within the royal circle. These actions, the Bruce family demonstrated the possibility of redemption and the restoration of favour through loyalty, strategic alliances, and the judicious use of power and influence within the volatile landscape of medieval Scottish politics. The Balliol and Comyn families, on the other hand, also emerged as significant figures as we know. The Balliol family, under the leadership of John Balliol, was a prominent force in the Scottish politics during William's reign. John Balliol's father, also named John Balliol, had established a foundation for the family's prominence through substantial landholdings and influential martial alliances. By the time of William I, the younger John Balliol was in the position of considerable power, holding lands across Scotland, but most notably in the Borders region. The Balliols' power and influence were not just a product of their landholdings, but also their connections to the English and Scottish crowns. Navigating this delicate balance of loyalty and ambition that often characterise a Norman nobility in Scotland. The alliance between the Comyn and Balliol families was a strategic partnership that strengthened both families' positions within the Scottish nobility. The Comyns, with extensive lands and power in the north and northeast of Scotland, were a formidable force in their own right. Their support for the Balliols likely stemmed from shared interests in maintaining and expanding their influence within the kingdom, as well as opposing common rivals among the Scottish nobility. This alliance was cemented and reinforced through strategic marriages that linked the two families, a common practice as we know. These marriages not only united the families but also created a network of mutual support that could be leveraged in dealings with the crown and other noble families. One other crucial family during William's reign was, of course, the FitzAlan family. They were represented by Walter FitzAlan, the son of the first Walter FitzAlan. This second Walter continued and expanded upon his father's legacy, serving as steward of Scotland with distinction. His tenure is marked by loyalty to William, through both military campaigns and administrative reform, helping to consolidate royal authority and manage the kingdom's burgeoning feudal system. The stewardship under his watch became an indispensable element of the Scottish governance structure, overseeing the administrative of justice, finances, and the king's lands. The transition of the FitzAlan family to Stuart is a fascinating evolution that reflects the family's growing identification with their role as stewards. The change is attributed to the adoption of the title Steward of Scotland as a surname, symbolising the hereditary nature of their position and their integral role within the Scottish kingdom. Over generations, the title became synonymous with the family itself, eventually morphing into Stuart, a name that would become well known to both Scottish and English people alike. But you ask, it wasn't just Norman families in medieval Scotland, what about the Gaelic noble families? Well, as we know, Scotland wasn't just home to the Norman noble families that David I brought along. There were the rightful landholders of Scotland, the Gaelic noble families, some with links back to Constantine himself. That's the Scottish Constantine, not the Roman one. The Gaelic nobles, often descended from ancient Scottish families, maintained significant influence in their regions, balancing the power of the Norman nobles who had been granted lands by previous kings. We'll explore some of the prominent Gaelic nobles during William's time. We had Malcolm, Earl of Fife. As a Mormer, or Earl of Fife, Malcolm held one of the most prestigious titles in Gaelic Scotland. The Earls of Fife had a hereditary right to crown the Kings of Scots, highlighting their significant ceremonial role. Beyond this, they were crucial military leaders and acted as royal advisors, underscoring their integral position within the kingdom's power structure. So that is Malcolm, Earl of Fife. We had Gael Brechtay, Earl of Strathearn. Gilbert of Strathearn was another influential Gaelic noble, overseeing the lands of Strathearn. His role included military leadership, judicial authority within his domain, and participation in the King's Council. But as we know, he was rebelling around this time due to, well, the murder of Uhtred. We had Donchad, Earl of Mar. The Earl of Mar controlled a vast and strategically important region in the northeast of Scotland. This role entailed not only military responsibilities, safeguarding the kingdom's northeastern frontier, but also governance of the region, overseeing the law, order, and managing the land's economic resources. We had Ulam, Earl of Ross. As a Mormer of Ross, Ulam's domain was in the northern part of Scotland, encompassing a mix of Gaelic and Norse influences. His role was multifaceted, involving the defence of his territories, administration of justice, and contribution to the king's military campaigns, especially in the regions where Gaelic and Norse cultures intersected. And then there was the Lord of Lorne. Though not an earl, he was a significant figure in the West. His power stemmed from his lineage and his ability to mobilise warriors, playing a crucial role in the defence of Western Scotland and the Isles. His authority extended to naval capabilities, especially for controlling the sea routes and defending against Norse incursions. These Gaelic nobles represented the enduring strength and influence of Scotland's Gaelic tradition within the kingdom's political and military spheres. Their roles were not critical not only in their respective territories, but also in the broader context of Scottish governance and defence. So they were critical. Each noble brought to the kingdom a deep connection to the Gaelic cultural heritage, ensuring its continuation and integration into the fabric of Scottish medieval society. Among these Gaelic nobles, certain figures stood out due to their extensive territories and influential roles within the kingdom. We obviously had Malcolm, who was the Earl of Fife. The Earl of Fife was powerful due to this prestigious title. He held that unique ceremonial privilege in crowning Scottish kings. This role, combined with their extensive lands in central Scotland, made Malcolm exceptionally influential. We obviously had the Earl of Strathearn. He did command a lot of territories, but due to his rebellion, we can't really count them a part of Scotland at the moment. Not until, well, he dies and William reclaims that land. The Earldom of Fife encompassed a rich agricultural land and strategic locations such as Falkland, which later became a favourite royal residence. Its central location enabled the Earls of Fife to exert influence across much of lowland Scotland, serving as a crucial nexus of political, economic and military power. While each Gaelic noble held substantial power within their respective domains, the Earls of Fife and Strathearn stood out due to their central roles in the kingdom's political and ceremonial life. The Norman noble families were slowly pushing the old guard out, but the Earl of Strathearn and the Earl of Fife especially held their ground and remained influential in the new Norman system. But there are some families that really don't align with either side, so we'll go through some of them now. We had the Macduff family. The Macduff, traditionally Earls of Fife until their lineage transitioned through the family line in the 12th century, continued to play a significant role in Scotland. Their historical right to crown the Kings of Scots and their considerable lands in Fife made them a central part of Scotland, until obviously that disappeared. You had the Mackenzie family. While the Mackenzies would come to greater prominence in later centuries, their roots trace back to the Gaelic nobility during William's reign. Their influence in the northwest, particularly in Ross and the surrounding areas, would grow over time, marking them as a family of note. You had the MacDonalds. They were Lord of the Isles. They controlled vast territories across the western mainland. Their naval power and autonomy made them akin to independent rulers, often negotiating directly with the kings of Scotland and Norway. You had the Douglas family. Even though the Douglas family's most famous exploits and expansion of power occurred in the centuries following William's reign, they were already an emerging force in southern Scotland. Their lands and influence would significantly increase, marking them as one of Scotland's most powerful families. You had the Murray family. The Murrays, with their lands primarily in the north and northeast, played a crucial role in defending Scotland's borders and maintaining the peace in these regions. You had the Leslie family. The Leslies, originally of Hungarian descent, were granted Scottish lands for their service to the crown by, yes, St. Margaret of Scotland. Over the time, they would become influential in Aberdeenshire and beyond, contributing to Scotland's military and political spheres. And then the Graham family. Holding lands in central and southern parts of Scotland, the Graians were another influential family whose power and influence would expand in the subsequent centuries. Their role in the kingdom's military and governance was notable, even during William's reign. Let's now maybe go over some of the relationships these families and these prominent nobles had with our King William. So, we've already mentioned him, but let's go through him quickly again. Walter FitzAlan, he was obviously very crucial to the crown. As Steward of Scotland, Walter was not only a key administrator, but also a trusted advisor to William. His loyalty and service to the crown were instrumental in the governance of the kingdom. We had David of Huntingdon. A younger brother to William I, David played a significant role in the kingdom, both as a royal family member and as a noble in his own right. We'll go through him later on in this episode, but David, he was a figure of note. We had Harold Maddison. As Earl of Orkney and the Lord of the Isles, Harold had a contentious relationship with his Scottish crown. Though he was a formidable power in the north and west, his interests often clashed with William's policy, leading to tension. He also remained under the king's sovereignty, but the tension was still there. We had Donchad, Earl of Carrick. The Earl of Carrick had a complex relationship with William. While not openly hostile, there were periods of tension and disagreement, reflecting the nuanced power dynamics between the crown and the Gaelic nobility. And then finally, we obviously had Uhtred's brother, Gilbert. He played a significant role in the resistance against the Scottish crown. The Galloway brothers' revolt underscores the regional tensions and complex relationship between the crown and its territories, though Gilbert would soon die and this land would return back to the Scottish king. These figures represent the spectrum of relationships between William and his nobles, from trusted advisors to rebellious lords. The loyalty of his confidants were crucial for William's administration and military campaigns, while the dissent and revolts led by figures like the Lords of Galloway posed significant challenges to his rule. These dynamics were emblematic of the feudal system of governance, where power was negotiated between the crown and the nobility, shaping the course of Scottish history during William I's reign. If we touch upon the Council of William now, it was composed of several key figures who played significant roles in the governance and administration of the kingdoms. These individuals, drawn from both the Norman and Gaelic nobility, were entrusted with various responsibilities, from military command to judicial and financial oversight. While not all roles and memberships are documented with precision, historical records and accounts provide insights into some of the prominent members of William's Council and their functions. The man, the myth, Walter FitzAlan, he was obviously the High Steward of Scotland. We've already gone over his role many times now, so we'll move on. We had Hugh de Morville. He was the Lord High Constable. As Lord High Constable, Hugh was charged with the command of the Royal Army in the King's absence and played a pivotal role in maintaining law and order. He was also involved in judicial matters, particularly those involving the military. So him and Walter FitzAlan did rule Scotland in William's stead, as he was, well, a hostage. We had David of Huntingdon. David is someone who we've neglected a little bit, haven't we, in our story. So let's touch upon him a bit now. Born around 1144 AD, David was one of the youngest sons of Henry of Scotland, who was Earl of Huntingdon and Northumbria, son of our great King David I. If you cast your mind back a few episodes, we had Malcolm IV as the eldest, then we had William I as the second oldest, and then David as the youngest of this trio. His birth into such a prominent family positioned David at the intersection of Scottish and English royalty, granting him a unique vantage point and role in affairs of both realms. David's trustworthiness in the eyes of William, his elder brother, stemmed from their familial relationship as well as David's proven loyalty and competence in matters of state and military. Think back to the reading of the Treaty of Fairlouz, if you did stay to the end of the episode, where David was a witness and was also forced to sign the treaty. That's how King Henry of England viewed David. He actually viewed him as a potential successor to William. His royal blood, combined with a reputation for wisdom and effectiveness, made him an invaluable advisor and confidant to the king. David's ties to England through his grandmother, Matilda, who was the daughter of King Malcolm III of Scotland as we knew, also provided William with a useful diplomatic channel, further enhancing his value to the Scottish crown. David's character and personal qualities contributed significantly to his standing. He was known for his piety, generosity, and patronage of religious institutions, reflecting the ethos of a medieval noble committed to the ideals of chivalry and Christian duty. His endowments to abbeys and participation in the foundation of monastic houses speak to a man deeply involved in the spiritual and temporal welfare of his domains. Moreover, David's marriages and offspring would leave a lasting legacy on the Scottish and English thrones, most notably through his granddaughter, Isabel of Huntingdon, whose descendants would come to rule Scotland. This lineage underscores David's importance not just as a noble and advisor, but as a progenitor of kings, weaving his legacy into the fabric of Scottish nobility. Moving on to further members of this council, we had Richard Comyn. Although not always listed among the top officials, Richard Comyn's influence as a landholder and his familial connections positioned him as an important advisor to William. We had William Douglas. The Douglas family, through rising to greater prominence in later centuries, were already landholders and military leaders. A member of this family would have provided military counsel and support for the king's campaigns. And then the Mormer of Mar. He overseed one of the key northern territories. The Mormer of Mar played a crucial role in the kingdom's defences, in administrative functions, but also in military affairs. And then we had Thomas of Galloway, the Lord of Lochaber. As a regional lord with significant influence in the Western Highlands, Thomas's role, though less documented, would have involved military leadership and managing relations with the Gaelic-speaking populations. These individuals, among others, formed the backbone of William's council, providing expertise and advice across a spectrum of issues facing the Scottish kingdom. Their roles underscored the collaborative nature of governance at the time, where decisions were influenced by a diverse group of nobles representing the varied interests and regions of Scotland. If we look to the church now, there are several ecclesiastical figures who stood out for their influence both within the Scottish church and in their interactions with the crown. William's tenure was marked by a significant development in the relationship between the Scottish monarchy and the church, notably his efforts to assert the independence of the Scottish church from the external, particularly English, ecclesiastical authority. This period saw a mix of cooperation and tension between the secular and religious authorities as he navigated the complex landscape of medieval politics. So if we go through some now, we had Jocelyn, who was the Bishop of Glasgow from 1175 to 1199. He was a key figure in the Scottish Church. He was instrumental in the development of the Glasgow Cathedral and the diocese. He also played a significant role in promoting the cult of St. Kentigern and was involved in the ecclesiastical affairs of the kingdom, advocating for the independence of the Scottish Church. We had Richard, Bishop of St. Andrews, who was born in 1163 to 1178. As a bishop of the most important see in Scotland, Richard was at the forefront of the church's interactions with the crown. His tenure was pivotal in the efforts to establish the ecclesiastical primacy of St. Andrews in Scotland. We had Hugh de Roxburgh, who was the Bishop of St. Andrews as well after Richard. Succeeding Richard, Hugh continued the work of bolstering the position of St. Andrews and the Scottish Church's independence. We had Matthew, Bishop of Aberdeen. Bishop Matthew played a crucial role in the development of the Diocese of Aberdeen, contributing to the ecclesiastical architecture and spiritual life of this see. His tenure reflects the broader efforts of Scottish bishops to enhance the autonomy and spiritual authority of the church in Scotland. We had Andrew, who was a Bishop of Caithness. Bishop Andrew's episcopacy is noted for the challenges he faced, including the violent opposition from local chieftains. His efforts to impose tithe payments and enforce church discipline in a remote and tumultuous region underscored the broader challenges faced by the Scottish Church, but also the Normanisation of Scotland as a whole. The quest for independence also led to tensions, as ecclesiastical appointments and the authority of Scottish bishops became a point of contention between the Crown and the Church. The balance between royal authority and ecclesiastical autonomy was a delicate one, with churchmen navigating the loyalty to the Pope and their relationship with the monarch. We're not talking about anything like a Thomas Becket here, but we're still talking about an intricate web of alliances and politics. but I think William did very well to work with the ecclesiastical apparatus of Scotland. He worked well with his bishops, and in the end, as we told in last week's episode, he became victorious, successfully making the Scottish Church independent from both the English Church, reporting directly to the Pope. This was a win, and this is where we left William in last week's episode, and this is where we'll leave him once more. I hope you all enjoyed delving into the intricate web of nobility during William's reign and exploring the various standing these noble families had with the king. It's been a fascinating journey through the political and social dynamics that shaped Scotland during this pivotal era. As we've seen, the relationships between William and his nobles were complex, marked by alliances, rivalries, and the contentious negotiation of power and influence. As time marches on, the fascinating aspect we observe is how these noble families, with their distinct identities and regional cultures, begin to merge and intertwine, contributing to the formation of a national Scottish identity. Yet, despite this convergence, the unique cultures of these regions have remained resilient, standing the test of time. These enduring traditions and identities continue to colour the tapestry of Scottish history, a testament to the diverse and rich heritage of Scotland. In our journey through the annals of Scottish history, we'll continue to track the evolving landscape of these noble families and how their fortunes and misfortunes shape the nation under the reigns of future kings and queens. The story of Scotland is ever changing, yet deeply rooted in the past, and we're just scratching the surface. Anyway, if we look ahead now to next week's episode, we'll be touching upon William's ambitious endeavour to secure Scotland's independence from England and the formidable King Richard of England. The saga of Scotland's fight for sovereignty is a thrilling chapter in its history, and I can't wait to share it with you, and hopefully this won't leave any lasting implications for the future kings and queens of Scotland. There's more excitement on the horizon as well. Following that, as I've told you last week, we'll be celebrating our 50th episode with a special Q&A segment, offering you the chance to dive deeper into the questions that have piqued your curiosity. Stay tuned for details on how to participate in next week's episode. I'll give you around 7 to 10 days to ask any questions, and then I'll record an episode answering them. I've already got quite a few questions that have already been sent through anyway, so keep sending them through if you already know the places to go to. If not, wait until next week, and I'll give you the official means of communication. Remember, our podcasts are released weekly, with 3 episodes a month, ensuring your regular dose of Scottish history. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @TheHistoryOfSC1, that is, @TheHistoryOfSC1, or on our Facebook page at The History of Scotland Podcast for updates and more fascinating insights. We'd love to hear your thoughts, so please leave a review on your preferred podcast platform if you can. You can listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other excellent podcasting sites. But until next week, guys, thank you for joining me again on this historical journey. Have a great week, stay safe, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace, guys.